Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I'm excited to have Nicholas Geisler with me. Hey, Nicholas.
How's it going?
I am doing great because I'm talking to you, and we just had an excellent, and I love when an interview goes long. We had a great long interview all about you and your film, When You Became Us, and that's the episode before this podcast, so people should totally check that out. In fact, I'll add, I met Nicholas because he brought his film, When You Became Us, to the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2022. It took home, just 4 awards. Outstanding Short Film Sci-Fi, Outstanding Director Sci-Fi, Outstanding Performance by an Individual, and I should name that was for Jack Vincenti, and Outstanding Performance by the entire cast. And I can't name everyone, but fantastic cast, and everyone did a great job. So bravo for When You Became Us. People should watch it, and they can watch it if they go to TV High, which is a smart TV app, and or I guess we call it a streaming service. So just go to watchtvhigh.com and find When You Became Us if you're listening to this. And oh yeah, my other disclaimer before we jump, this is a 4 questions episode, which means Nicholas is going to answer, name 3 favorite films, name a film that's underrated, name a film that's overrated, and name a lesser known film for people to seek out. But before I have Nicholas answer, I am giving my Zoom disclaimer. We're talking on Zoom, which means there is a micro delay and we're not talking over each other. But for some reason with Zoom, when you record the audio, kind of like sometimes people talk over each other because there's a micro delay that we don't sense. So anyway, and if you don't like the sound quality, whatever, I think at this point, COVID made us all accept shitty sound quality for podcasts.
Oh yeah, we live in the Zoom aesthetic these days. We can muddle through it.
And it's funny, massive podcasts were started using Zoom because they had to.
Yeah.
With that said, Nicholas, Want to name your favorite films? A few.
Three of. And I'm gonna snapshot. And I very intentionally tried to. We talked a lot in the previous podcast about quality trumps genre, so I'm going to try and mix and match my genres a little bit. First one, I always watch it. I think the script is like 2 lines away from absolute perfection, is Martin McDonagh's In Bruges. I think the line he plays tonally is insane. I think it builds in and out of set pieces. I think not a single line of dialogue is wasted. Every little moment matters. The characters are deep. He takes what could be kind of, you know, Hitman body comedy should be tired. We should be done with Hitman body comedies. And he elevates it into something, I think, truly brilliant, truly genius. The characters are real. They're resonant. He puts in deeply spiritual and religious themes, but he buries them in a way that they never overshadow character. And to walk that line between comedy and drama and tragedy, not just in the movie, but in scenes, to whip from tragedy to comedy. To me, that's the best, in a very not relatable life situation, that's the most relatable tone. And it's something that I have shamelessly tried to copy and mimic my entire creative career since I saw it. On the other end of that spectrum, do we talk about these in between? Should I just keep going?
Go on. I mean, I sometimes I wait till you name all 3, but In Bruges is amazing. And honestly, I think Martin McDonagh is like, if you asked me to like rank his films, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, he kind of hasn't missed yet.
I totally agree. And Banshees of Inisherin was my movie of the year last year. Same, just so individual, like the Howie is on one hand both so idiosyncratic and yet so deeply human and relatable. I mean, that is to me what great art is. It is a voice, a distinguishable voice that then speaks to a broad number of people in their own interior lives. And he's just, I think, one of the most incredible filmmakers out there doing that.
For sure. And I'm just going to name 7 Psychopaths and 3 Billboards. What is it? 3 Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. But like, unbelievable storytelling. Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And very, very. Also, he refuses to be locked in. And also, for anyone who loves those, check out his plays. And you can pick a lot of them up. They've printed a lot of really nice copies. You see it. You see where he came from, and he's just as good and evocative on the stage as he is. I haven't been lucky enough to see you play, but I've read several of them. And man, if you are a writer, you can learn. There are a lot worse people to learn from, say that.
And makes me almost want to say that, yeah, when playwrights jump into the film medium, there's a slightly better understanding, I think, of dialogue and performance.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. You there, it's add all of a sudden, I think for them, film becomes additive. They've nailed character and performance and dialogue. And then you get to add the beauty of something only a camera can do. You get to direct the eye in a way that you can't do on stage as much. And I think, yeah, you're right. I think you nail those, to me, the more crucial skills of character and plot. And then you get to add a whole nother medium on top. That only elevates the heart of the script.
For sure. All right. So now you're going to jump genres, I guess.
I'm going to jump genres. Although you can probably find the thread between all three of these films. And maybe what I would call my personal lookbook. I'm going to go with Anchorman. I think that movie doesn't necessarily, I almost said it for my underrated, although so many people love it and quote it. I don't think you can call it underrated. I saw it at a time, you know, I think it's easy to forget how much McKay Farrell changed what we view as his comedy, and how well they brought in absurdity in ways that, you know, had maybe dipped post Zucker's and Airplane and kind of had fallen out in some ways. But this brilliant, like just shy of surrealism. It came out when I was 12, I think. And I was watching it, and halfway through the movie, something clicked. I'm like, I see what's funny about this. The characters are so lived in. The sets are beautiful. The soundtrack is incredible. It is slyly like way ahead of its times in terms of what the comedy is punching at. And every character, every person's having so much fun making the movie. Clearly, they're having an absolute blast. They love their characters. I think the humor is this incredible high-low pastiche that just works still. You know, I haven't seen it long. I'm curious how much I'd laugh, but every time I'd seen it, it felt richer and deeper and more idiosyncratic than I think the reputation of this kind of like feral, big, broad comedy is. It's a weird movie. It's a very sneakily strange film. And the fact that they made it look so good. I mean, they actually cared about production design and some really inspired shots and knew, you know, how to make it feel lived in, but also comedic. I think it was a harbinger of comedy to come for another two decades. And I just think it, beyond just a funny movie, I think it deserves a little more critical acclaim. It's not my undervalued movie, but I'm going to go to bat for it.
Fair enough. And I don't know what the thread is going to be through the three, but I mean, I got to mention that Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, I mean, they started as groundlings, right? Like they started with live theater.
Yes, it did.
Which, how is there a better test of are you funny or not than having living people in chairs in front of you? And if they don't laugh, you bombed. And
no,
if they
that's it. Laugh,
you go home and you enjoy life. Like, yeah, I mean, but yeah, such a subversively weird film.
Yeah.
And yet, just, I mean, I... Obviously, like the common comment is like, how quotable is the film? Like when a comedy is that quotable,
right?
My only issue is it allows unfunny people I know to quote it and think they're funny.
Yes, and look, it's a victim of its own success, and I think it's, you know, there's worse places to be. And look, I think The Big Short is a hell of an accomplishment. I think The Other Guys, another very subversive McKay Farrell comedy, is sneakily subversive. I mean, The Other Guys, the bad guy is corrupt hedge fund managers, if I'm not mistaken. But it's where it all started. And yeah, you're right. It's just, it got so good. I think people quote it and they forget just how weird and idiosyncratic it ended up being. But you're right. Actually, you said go ahead.
Sorry. Well, and I'll add that, I mean, and in your interview, we talked about the importance of justice and social justice. Mm-hmm. And Adam McKay went from a groundling and an SNL writer, and the guy who made Anchorman to making those amazing, like you mentioned The Big Short, but also Vice. Like he makes important shit now.
Yeah, right.
and he's funny. But
he's funny.
But and yeah, he's funny. It's, really cares deeply about justice.
Yes.
And importance. And actually, Anchorman, I'll add, is a very before people really started, I'm sure at universities they were talking about the patriarchy for decades. But Anchorman was really one of the first examples I can think of where a purely feminist story allowed a woman to bring down the traditional alpha male. They made it a comedic alpha male, but still, there's a point to Anchorman as far as that.
It's about misogyny in the workplace and cracking that open. And what I also love about it, because, you know, God, we talk about forever, is Christina Applegate, part performance, part writing. She's also very funny. Like, it's not the shoehorned in, like, here's a moral. Like, and I think that's maybe Adam McKay's hallmark now, is like, I'm going to make things that are entertaining, but the style matches, the form matches the function. And it's not just going to tack on a lesson. Like, you cannot pull apart how he's telling this and the comedy he's using from why he's telling it and how he's getting his point across. And he got there early with Anchorman, and it's been I quote and think I'm funny probably. And I'm sorry to say I probably not always, but you did also mention, I think you're right. You got there, the live performance aspect of it. Maybe, I'm going to cheat and tie my third movie. Because I can't choose between the two of them, would be Robert Altman's. What's that?
You can name two more.
All right. So it's cheap, but I'm going to take it. It's Robert Altman's Nashville and Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Again, both very lived in naturalist. I mean, I think for McCabe and Mrs. Miller, he famously invented a microphone that allowed him to basically put on a living, breathing place and just record every bit of audio and dialogue from different places. McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I mean, he literally had the carpenters in costume building the set around the movie while he's filming. Because for those who haven't seen it, it's about the West. It's an anti-Western. It's about the growth of this mining outpost into a town. And so literally they're building sets in the background. He's shooting it chronologically. So you can see the town being built, the actual town being built as he's filming the movie. And Nashville, I love country music. I love that era of country music. I love ensembles. I love feeling deep in a world. I mean, Anchorman's in Bruges, maybe not an ensemble, but every character in Bruges crucially has a distinct POV and their own dialogue. Anchorman, ensemble, every one of those actors kills every part they have. But Nashville and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, to me, are the best examples of what I really, really aspire to in making something, which is creating a world that, even if it's a funhouse mirror, is a reflection of our own. And that means there are a lot of loose ends that the minute the camera stops, the frame stops, you understand that multiple stories are continuing, that multiple stories happened before you even got there, that every single person on screen in some way, even if it's their own story, matters. Again, it's humanist filmmaking. And I think humanism is probably, if there's ever a guiding philosophy for me, and not just creatively, but in life, it'd be humanism. And the value of every story and every person and what they bring and what they matter to the collective, how individuals matter to the collective. And I don't think anyone's done that better than Altman. Obviously, you know, there are people who have done very well on individual, but Nashville and McCabe and Mrs. Miller, you can watch them 100 times and you're going to see a different story and find a new through line, or find a character you wish you could follow, as it keeps going. Every single time you watch it. And that, if there's not a better aspiration for filmmaking than that, then I don't know what is, at least personally.
Absolutely. No, I mean, Altman is one of the masters, and I like that you're going back to the early stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. He just can. I love The Long Goodbye, even though that movie is super messy. I don't even know when that falls in timeline for him, but yeah. So he's a master, and his name will briefly come up again, maybe in a later question, but we'll see.
Excellent. All right. Well, question number two is a film that is underrated.
So related, I think you tell me if I'm cheating, because I have a lot of friends who hate this movie, and I think when it came out, it wasn't super well received. I think it's maybe getting more due now, finally. But a disciple of Altman, Paul Thomas Anderson, I think people think Inherent Vice is his worst movie. I think it's one of his best. And I don't know what you've heard. I have a lot of friends who hate it. I've gotten a lot of heated discussions, which is why I feel okay calling it underrated. I remember early on, it's the beginning of his decline, which I think is bullshit. But I don't know. Do you think that's a fair underrated?
Well, I am going to confess this is please don't lose complete respect for me.
Uh-huh.
I haven't seen it yet. And I claim to be a huge Paul Thomas Anderson fan. I loved Phantom Thread. Mm-hmm. But I didn't catch it in the theaters. And it got the negative press.
Yeah.
And I just haven't sat down and watched it.
All right. So here's my pitch to you. Here's my pitch. I love noir. I absolutely love noir. I think he's the first person to really both understand it and what it comes from, which is it's not actually to me about, you know, the... To me, there's an ambiguity of the idea of truth in noir. And people, I think, over-index on the ambiguity of morality. I mean, look, Bogart is a little complex in a lot of that stuff, but he's the good guy. It's not that hard to see it. But what was more important to me in noir was the ambiguity of truth. The idea that the small guy is being wrapped up and there's these huge mysteries that are destroying society, often corporate, often big moneyed. And all you can do is like kind of save the people you care about. And know that you have to live to fight another day. Inherent Vice takes that to me and drenches it in marijuana. I think if you, a fun game is to smoke a little bit of a joint every time Joaquin Phoenix does, because then you're in his mind state. Because to me, it is a masterpiece in subjective POV. And all the old noir books are first person. And you are living in that truth, the weird, muddled confusion of the narrator, of the PI as he's working. And we have never seen it done better in film than Inherent Vice. Because, yes, the plot is deliberately confusing. It backends on itself all of the time. It opens up story threads and has no interest in closing them. You do forget who characters are, but so is the main character. And the ultimate point is that there is an enormous, vast, moneyed class dictating a lot of lives, and all you can do is hope to protect yourself and save the people you love. And that will go on. There is no pat resolution to that ever. The one PI is not going to bring that down. And also, I think it's funny as fuck. I think it's hilarious. It's a perfect getting high movie. And I'll defend it till the day I die, until I watch it one day and say, oh, young Nicholas, you were wrong. But I will, until then, I think it got a lot of bad press for no good reason.
You're probably right. All right. Well, and I let that keep me away from it.
And I did for a while too. I read the book, which eventually is why I ended up watching it.
Pinchon, right?
What's that?
It's Pinchon?
Yeah. And the book is different and the book is good, but the book is also very confusing. And I think to me, the big criticism was, I think, and this is a slippery critical slope, I admit, but I think successfully the confusion was the point. It wasn't a mistake that the plot was confusing. That is a thematic necessity. And I think that understanding is what flipped me on this movie believing it's a PTA masterpiece.
Yeah, it's funny. I have not read enough Pinchon, but I love writers who love him.
Yeah. All right. He's like one of those people I feel like who's trickled into the fabric without necessarily being deeply. I've only read two, three. I liked Vineland a lot. And Vineland was another weird one of his. But he's got some talent.
I started Gravity's Rainbow.
Yeah, I haven't gotten into it. It's one of those same. It's been,
and I was loving it, but somehow I didn't get through it.
I can see it. It's over there staring me down on the bookshelf right now.
Oh, it's the book that haunts you. It's the book.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
Come on, read me. You got to read me someday.
Sooner or later, it's like, yeah, little things first.
I got to read it too. I got to. What my problem is, I used to be a library book guy.
Mm-hmm.
Because my wife doesn't believe in clutter, the clutter of a bookshelf.
Yeah.
And so I would get 100, 200 pages in, and then LA Public Library only lets you renew your rental of it or whatever you're checking out of it for like two renewals and then you got to return it. And I was like, damn, I'd return it. And then I'd be like, when I start reading, I got to start again in the beginning.
Yep. Right. Yeah. You don't have the time to like sit in it no matter what your schedule is. Yeah. I also have a huge overdue fee on, budgeting for independent filmmakers that I've been using to craft budgets that I can't check anything out until I return it, but I've used all my things and I'm still reading it. So I can't.
If only we talked 3 years ago, you know, during COVID, they did the thing where they forgave all fees.
Yep. Oh yeah. I got a lot forgiven. I'll be honest.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm going to have to watch Inherent Vice. All right. So the third question is a film that is overrated.
I'm curious if I'm the first person to say this. I get a lot of flack for this. I understand the flack, but I believe in my convictions here. And I have a hunch I'm not going to be the first person to answer this. I can't do Forrest Gump. I can't do it. I think Zemeckis is great. He's a talented filmmaker. Tom Hanks is good at what he's doing, whatever it is. But ultimately, that movie boils down to me to a man literally running through American history and a greatest hits of like, it plays like one of those like old late night ads for like greatest hits albums, just of like boomers' historical memories. And every time I watch it, I'm just like, I don't want to see you walking through MLK speech. I definitely don't want to see you scolding the Black Panthers. I don't want to see you doing this accent. Jenny is the worst. And I know it's kind of the point, but it's also kind of not. And Tom Hanks is good. And a lot of the supporting actors are good. Tom Hanks is good, again, at whatever he's doing as a character. But I think it's a fine movie. But I'm comfortable saying it's overrated because I think the amount of enduring acclaim, I just don't get it. It just didn't connect with me. And I've tried. I really have. But I think something about the very conceit of it just has always rubbed me the wrong way and I can't get past it.
Well, it is very much you nailed it with the baby boomer thing. It's baby boomer masturbatory. we are the most important generation ever. And everything that happened in our lifetimes is the most important thing ever.
Yeah.
And no one who came after us has a right to claim that they're important or young.
Yep.
Yeah.
We invented rock and roll and politics and social. It's just, I don't know. Again, I know there's a point where I think I've become a character of myself because this has come out in like writers' rooms and I've just like had to re-defend my position so many times. It's made me like it less. Like I imagine the first time I said this, I'm like, yeah, I don't really care for it. And now every time I have to bring it up, it's pulled me further down the pendulum of like, I can't stand it. But there's a lot of good movies out there. I just don't think it's one of them as far as I'll go.
I remember liking it, but when it won Best Picture, I can't remember what it beat. But I have a hunch if I looked it up, if I hit pause and looked it up, I'd be like, how'd it beat that film? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, but you want to, I see you, for those who aren't watching Nicholas on Zoom, he's definitely looking that up because he wants to know too. What superior film that Forrest Gump defeated?
It won so much. Best documentary, best visuals. I don't need that. Well, Pulp Fiction was out that year. Best Picture, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and The Shawshank Redemption.
A lot of people be mad that Shawshank lost to Forrest Gump.
Yeah, I think so too. And look, from the last two times I saw him, I think it's Shawshank's a better movie. I'll stand by that. I never saw Quiz Show.
It was good, but just a mood, just a drama.
Yeah, I had a hunch that wasn't going to win. I also, along that, I should note, if I can go back to a favorite or maybe slightly underrated, although it's not, I think everybody should watch Network. I think that movie holds up. I think it's a fantastic movie. It's very funny. It's just a good movie. Not Network. Broadcast News.
Network and a favorite before, for sure. All right, well, I think Forrest Gump is legit. I don't think that many people be mad at you for it.
Okay.
Well, surely some, and surely baby boomers.
I will say I once did have a first date ruined by that. I said it, and she said it was her favorite movie, and the date literally skidded to a halt there, and we never saw each other again. So it has ruined.
But isn't that a first date that should have been the only date?
Exactly. It taught me everything. We walked away, neither of us very upset that it ended. So.
By the way, based on your preamble, based on, I'm blanking on the word for, but based upon the way you introduced it, I thought maybe you were going to go for Godfather. But
No. I will say my second choice, if I want to lose some people, I almost hesitate to say it. It's not a huge Everything Ever All at Once fan.
Yeah, it's a little divisive. Because like if it was the Oscar for most enjoyable film of the year.
Yes.
But is it best picture? I don't know if it's the best. I really enjoyed the shit out of it. And I think if I watch it 20 times, I'll enjoy it 20 times. Yeah. But it's not like, it's great, but it's not like you bring up Inherent Vice. Like I'm a There Will Be Blood guy.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, oh yeah, it's on par with There Will Be Blood, which by the way, which lost out to No Country for Old Men, and I'll never get over that. But
yeah. And look, Banshees of Inner Sheeran, I love that movie so much. I thought that was such a rich movie. In terms of best picture. And I will say the Daniels, I can make an argument that they deserve maybe best director because that had to have been hell to direct that movie and keep that thing anywhere near cohesive. But anyway, I digress. Anyway.
For sure. For sure. Well, the last one is a lesser known film for people to seek out.
I love that you had this question, by the way, because I think it's just very fun. I'm going to go with, I've seen it three times in the past year, I think, partially because I was working, it was a good tonal comp for me, but it's called Who Are You, Polly Magoo? It's by William Klein. It was last I saw on Criterion. I think it's now on Amazon. It's kind of sort of Snow White-ish, but it's about a fashion model. William Klein was a photographer for Vogue. And then he made this film with this beautiful model who never acted or modeled again. It's a satirical takedown of fashion, high fashion, and modeling in general. But it's so far ahead of its time. It feels like it was made yesterday. It's one, there's all these crazy, like animated Monty Python, like pre Monty Python esque, like animation interludes and overcoming. There's a lot of plots that kind of intersect and surreal over the top. It's gorgeous. He's a fashion photographer. He knows how to set mise-en-scene. He knows how to use color, use light. It's black and white, so no color. It's satirical. And what I love about it, what I keep watching it, is it was made for the French fashion scene in the late 60s, early 70s. I can't quite remember the year. But it reads today like this perfect evisceration of influencers and Instagram culture. Like I'm blown away by how perfectly in capturing what being a model during the heyday of Vogue really was and how it flattened personality into corporate interest and destroyed individualism and how then everybody else then creates meaning on somebody and makes the model who they want them to be. You sub out the word model for influencer and it's perfect. It's still perfect. It still holds up. And it's, I just, for a movie to be that precisely biting of a satire that long ago, that to me, it still feels like it's satirizing today. It blows me away. And it's also funny and weird and looks beautiful. And I'm ashamed. I found it because I was working on something about influencers, I was writing something about influencers. And I don't remember quite how I got to it, but I watched it. I couldn't believe I haven't seen 1,000 think pieces about like, forgotten French film gem, Who Are You, Polly Magoo? Like, says everything. Like, I just can't believe it's not everybody. Everybody hasn't, you know, cinephiles haven't kind of rediscovered it. But that's my pitch for it, I guess. I really loved it.
I really want to watch it. I mean, besides loving French cinema, yeah, the animation and stuff, that sounds really intriguing.
Yeah. And it's gloriously messy. There is a color in Relude, actually. I believe there's some color in it. And then there's it's tonally ambitious. It's wildly assured and taking huge swings. It astounds me. And it's the kind of thing that makes you love to make films because somebody really put it all out there to make something.
1966 avant-garde, that's when is whatever that was. I'm gonna tip my Beatles hand and mention this came out the year that Revolver came out. Like, this was when everything was changing in culture globally. I mean,
it feels like Revolver. It's seeped in it, in like implicit and explicit social critique. But also, again, it's humanist. It's got a human soul. Pauly Magoo's story is ultimately it's not empty satire in the sense that it's just biting. It's not just pure irony. There is a sincere core somewhere in there. And I think it says a lot that the lead actress never modeled or acted ever again after doing this. And it was not because she had a bad time on set. It was, I think, she saw what this life had done to her.
Wow. Well, in an effort to be clever, I'm going to make a point of watching it. And then I'm going to use this prepared line, which is, it's the tomorrow never knows of cinema. There you go.
All right. I like that.
Right? Like the song that the Beatles came up with in 1966, that like today is cutting edge and insanely, like, no one's ever done anything like that. And it's just so avant-garde and crazy.
Yep. Hey, look, perfect. We can talk about it all day, but I've been re-listening to Pet Sounds and I'm still like, geez, no one's taking risks like Brian Wilson. Anyway, we'll go on for days, but I appreciate it.
Yeah, you can't bring in music. Definitely can't bring music. Although music, you'll appreciate this. The whole reason the four questions exist in this podcast is because I have a friend who's a professional session drummer, and his Facebook for a decade was solely challenging people on these questions, but for music. So he'd be like, most overrated drummer of all time. Neil Peart of Rush, challenge me. Like, most underrated band of all time, you know, Minutemen. Like, he was just like, he was, and I was like, you know what? I love James's questions. I'm gonna just ask them for film.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I love it. And it's fun too, because, you know, I feel like even the movies we just talked about, that I'm the one who posited them, I feel like I actually know them a little bit deeper now. And just, it's fun to like examine them and kind of go back and forth on them. So I appreciate it.
And I can't even, absolutely. I'll just shut up instead of trying to sound clever. So, hey, I'm going to put those clickable links that you mentioned at the end. Nicholas is now petting Luna, the beautiful Australian Shepherd who I've enjoyed watching her walk around the room. She needs her walk.
She's been very, very, the fact that no one out there has heard her bark is something that I'm shocked and impressed with. So she deserves a nice long walk.
She's a good one. But if you go to discoverindiefilm.com for this episode, you'll see that she's in the background. She's on the bed behind Nicholas. So you can see the beautiful pup. All right. Anyway, thank you for listening to the Discover Indie Film podcast. If you want to learn more about it, just go to discoverindiefilm.com. It's at DIF Wins on social media. Go to Amazon Prime Video and type in Discover Indie Film, and you will find, hopefully do it on a nice big TV. You'll find a TV series that has to date 7 seasons. I might tell Nicholas what's going on with season 8 after this, but there's 7 seasons. It's just an anthology of short films on Amazon Prime Video. I met Nicholas because his film, When You Became Us, was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. We hold that festival every November. So just go to ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. It's sister festival we hold every June. It's Film Invasion Los Angeles. You can learn about that if you go to FilmInvasionLA.com, and it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And finally, I think we already talked about TV High. Just go to WatchTVHigh.com. If you sign up through one of the smart TV apps, so Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, Android TV, iPhone and Android Mobile, if you sign up through their app stores, it's $4.99. If you sign up for TV High at watchtvhigh.com, it's $4.20 a month. And if you use the code STREAM420, actually, you get a month free trial instead of a week free trial. So, curious if these podcasts will lead to any free trials. Well, I never know.
You never know. We'll find out soon enough. I'll be sharing it around. I'm so thankful that if I can jet in, so thankful for this opportunity, so thankful for you. You do incredible work for the film community, both in LA and everywhere else. The Sherman Oaks Film Festival is a total gas, and everybody should be going to it. It was the best festival I've been to, and I still talk to the people I met there, and still work with the people I met there. So thank you for everything, Jeff. It's very appreciated.
Thank you. I appreciate everything you just said. You know, that's basically why we do it. So that's why I do it. Needless to say, I was just about to joke about the fact that running film festivals, I have a very kind and thoughtful life partner because, the arts, I can't picket anyone to ask for a raise because we're a nonprofit.
Not easy, but it's good work. It's good work.
More power, and hopefully by the time people are listening to this, the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes have resulted in something wonderful that leads to decades of wonderful storytelling. And Nicholas Geisler, thank you. More power to you. I hope to see more work from you.
I hope to share.
And I suppose I should, for shits and giggles, I should look up the Random Ass News Network.
Yeah, don't judge me too harshly on the early work.
I just appreciate that as a young man, you named something that you were working on. You use the word ass in the title. I respect that, personally.
Keep it clean. Ran. But we know.
Hmm?
It was where we our logo was Ran. But we broke. That's the thing. We slipped an ass in there.
So it was R-A-N, but it didn't say Random Ass News.
It does. You know what? I don't actually remember. It's definitely out there. We'll find it. Thank you.
That's clever, though. R-A-N, yeah. All right. Hey, I will. We can obviously chat for another hour, so yeah. I will just thank you again. And thank you, everyone, for listening.